The changing ecosystem in the Gulf of Maine and what it means for marine life. The ocean is an ever-changing environment, but it's often difficult to see what's going on beneath the surface. What we know is that the water temperature in the Gulf of Maine is rising by about a half degree each year, and that the waters are becoming more acidic. Lobsters seem more abundant than ever, while other fish, especially cod, are not. This spring, many boaters couldn't believe how many jellies, what we used to call jellyfish, were around, and marine ecologists are struggling to figure out what should be done about the explosion in the invasive green crab population. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about the creatures in the Gulf of Maine, what's disappearing, what's new, and what might just come back. Maine Calling dives deep, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Do you spend time on the ocean? Have you noticed any creatures lately that you've never seen before? Ever wondered what you don't know about life below the surface? Big and small, there are incredible creatures living in Maine's waters. And today on Maine Calling, we're talking with some of the people who study and care for the vast life that dwells just off the coast. With me in the studio, Janet Gannon. She is a marine biology instructor at Bowdoin College. Adam Baucus is research associate at Gulf of Maine Research Institute. And Joe Payne is Casco Bay Keeper with Friends of Casco Bay. As always, we want to hear from you. What are your questions about our marine ecosystem? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you for what I'm sure is going to be a very popular show. And Joe Payne, why don't I start with you? What are the biggest changes of marine life that you've witnessed over the years that you've been out on the water?
Well, you know, Jennifer, I think about change because my grandfather was a Casco Bay waterman, and I think about, you know, 70 years perhaps he spent on the water, and I doubt that he saw much change. I think it stayed, you know, to his perception, relatively the same, whereas in the last 10 or 20 years, there's been a lot of change. For me, growing up on Peaks Island, I used to go fishing off the back shore for cunner. Any day, any time, you could catch cunner. Then there were no more cunner to catch. So on the deficit side, that was an indicator to me. But, you know, what everyone is seeing, what I'm getting questions about all the time are, where are all these jellyfish coming from? Why do we have so many green crabs? I mean, the only people who are really fond of green crabs now are still kids at the beach, you know, turning over rocks, catching green crabs. But those are big, obvious, everyone can notice changes that we've seen.
All right. And I'll ask each of you the same question. From your perspective, Janet, what are you seeing as big changes?
I would say there's actually some really exciting changes that we should mention as well. And one would be things like we've taken a lot of dams out in Maine, so we're seeing more alewives. So I would add to Joe's comments that not all of these changes are necessarily things that are frightening, but maybe we're making changes that are better for our environment.
And I was out last week with some folks from Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and they were happily surprised by how many young alewives they were catching in their seine nets. Adam, bringing you into the conversation, what are the changes that you all are studying?
Well, working out on commercial fishing boats, you know, I see a wide variety of fish species, and we're really seeing, you know, especially recently, some new additions that are not uncommon, but you really see them further south. Fish like black sea bass, squid, butterfish is another good example. So fish that it's not absolutely crazy to see them in the Gulf of Maine, but really traditionally you're seeing them south of Cape Cod, and they're becoming more and more common here.
That's interesting because, do you believe that's because of the changing water temperature, the warming of the ocean?
That certainly is one of the bigger factors.
Okay.
Hard to pinpoint it down to one, but that's a big one.
Right, and from what I've read, getting prepared for this program, that the ocean is warming by about a half a degree a year in the Gulf of Maine, which seems pretty dramatic. Like we could see some really big population shifts. Are we seeing those shifts already?
I think we are. I get a lot of comments from people. I get people email me and ask me, what is this thing I'm seeing that happens to me a lot? And a lot of times they're asking me about tunicates, which probably a lot of invasive species. Tunicate, there's a lot of invasive tunicates in Maine now.
What is a tunicate?
A tunicate is, it's actually a relatively close relative of vertebrates. If people were looking at the intertidal, they might look like orange or red or white kind of blobs. And they actually can, I actually tell my students they're a lot like the blob, like the movie The Blob that just overgrows everything. And that happens in the intertidal. And so we can expect that as things get warmer, invasive species will find it easier to come in. That's something that we do expect to have happen.
Okay, Joe, earlier you mentioned green crabs. What do we know about green crabs? I understand they've been brought in the holds of shipping vessels for, you know, a long time. Why now? Why is the green crab population exploding now as opposed to 100 years ago?
Well, the first best answer is exactly what Adam said before, and it's hard to pinpoint to one reason. But green crabs have been in Casco Bay for about 100 years. In the 50s, there was a big explosion of green crabs, and it was due to higher temperatures, higher summer temperatures. Then in the 60s, they died off because we had colder winter temperatures. And now we're back with warmer temperatures, warmer water, warmer air temperatures. The green crabs are able to proliferate. And if they don't get killed back by cold in the winter, then their population starts strong, a lot of crabs, and they're so prolific. A 2-inch female crab can have 160,000 eggs. So they can procreate like crazy. So warm temperatures, their ability to procreate, and the fact that they are invasive means their natural suite of predators isn't here. So while everything here eats them, I mean gulls eat them, fish eat them, you know, everything eats them, there are a lot more things where they came from that eat them and keep them in check. So people are hoping for a cold winter to kill them back. But the other side of that news is it's been discovered through DNA testing that they're hybridizing with a species from around Iceland, a more cold-tolerant species. So now we don't even know if cold winters will knock them back, although our recent cold December seems to have affected them this year. But the catch is picking up, and who knows what next week will bring.
What are the adverse impacts of green crabs? What do they do to everything else?
Well, they love clams, little tiny clams, and they're great. I sound excited about that. I'm not excited that they're so great at finding and eating clam spat, the smallest clams. So that's a big hit to clamors families, and the coastal economy. They also tear up eelgrass beds, and there are some stunning pictures of once prolific, like 5 years ago, eelgrass beds, which is our most important habitat beyond the water itself. And now there's a picture of McCoit Bay, dozens and dozens of acres without a blade of eelgrass. That has a hit on the whole environment. So if you think about clams, mussels, eelgrass, that's enough damage for any species to do.
I'm an ocean swimmer, and all of my swimming friends have been sending lots of emails about the great white shark sighting in Duxbury, Massachusetts. I guess a lot of people talking about it because it's not off Chatham and Cape Cod. It's a little further north. Do we have great white sharks here in Maine, and when are we going to have our first big news story?
Well, I would say we definitely have great white sharks here. You know, those are large ocean predators. They're covering a lot of ground. If they're in Chatham, it's not going to take them a whole lot of time to get here. That's not to say they're everywhere, but you know, the sharks are going to follow where their food source is, and there's a lot of seals in the area, and especially now we're seeing more gray seals, and so those are the real big ones. When you're looking out on the harbor, you'll see, especially here in Casco Bay, you'll see a lot of harbor seals, and they have sort of the more rounded face, and then every now and then you'll see these big gray, dark horse faces popping out of the water, and those are the big gray seals. And you know, if you're a white shark, that's a tasty little treat right there. You're looking for the big sausage, and that's so. I think there are sharks around. They've been spotted. You know, the fishermen see them offshore. Again, it's not all the time, but it's not that uncommon.
Yeah, there was a film clip 2 years ago of a great white off Eastport, inshore.
Eastport.
Yeah.
We're not talking southern Maine. Wow,
no, they're
Janet.
Here.
there was a great white shark seen in Passamaquoddy Bay in late July. Pretty good footage of it. So it's not unusual. Actually, one of the largest great whites was caught on Grand Manan Island just across the Canadian border quite a while ago. But obviously, these are not an unusual fish. So we do have them. I don't think it's anything people need to worry about, though.
Okay, so if you're headed to the beach this beautiful Labor Day weekend, you can still go, right?
Absolutely.
That's our advice. You mentioned earlier, Janet, that we're seeing more alewives. What can that mean in the future? Will it have an impact on other species?
Well, you know, you also said there's more baby alewives out there, and the more baby alewives we have, the more adults we have. Alewives are a bait fish. It's a possibility that they're important for the groundfish recovery. So if we have more things that people are, you know, that fish are eating, then we can have more cod, things like that. I think it's also really exciting that we're returning some of our freshwater habitat by having alewives return to those habitats. They haven't been there for a long time.
Okay, and Adam, do you have anything to add to that? Because I know Gulf of Maine Research Institute is doing a lot of work
on
this. Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly. We've done some work in the past up in Penobscot Bay, you know, so there's an area where they've recently done a lot of dam removals, and you're seeing this, you know, surge of alewives returning to areas. They're opening up a lot of freshwater habitat for them, and so we've been doing some work really trying to focus on that connection of, so you've got all this basically energy source coming out of the river in the form of alewives, and what does that mean for Penobscot Bay and the marine end of things? And just in the short term, you know, we're still sorting through a lot of that information, but those forage fish are important for a lot of things, especially things like mackerel, codfish, and things that are really near shore that are, you know, these fast mobile predators that are able to track down these small bait fish.
Your organization is organizing a symposium on sea lice. What is a sea lice, and or are sea lice, and why is this important to understand? Is this something that we have more of than we used to?
Well, that's a good question. That's a little outside of my range. That might be also, there's other companies in the building, the Fish Vet Organization. They specialize in things like that. And that's, you know, as aquaculture is growing in the state, that's something that we want to learn more and more about.
Okay. And so I'm looking at my list of critters I want to talk about, and I want to return to the jellies. Joe, you noticed and said you're getting a lot of calls about jellies, learned just this year that they are called jellies now and not jellyfish, as sea stars are no longer called starfish. Do we know why these jellies are appearing more often in Maine waters, or is this another thing where, well, it might be ocean warming, it might be something else?
Might be a lot of things, but the two factors that people point to are currents, because jellies, you know, they don't say, I'm going over there and then make a beeline. They go with currents. And so changes in currents bring them inshore, and warmer temperatures are conducive to their growth. So, you know, that's the two main reasons people are saying we have them. But it's dramatic when you go to the inner bays of Casco Bay. You can just see jellies. You know, you look in the water, and they're touching each other, you know, for as far as you can see. And that's a change in my experience. We used to see them for about a month, and they're common, generally the common moon jelly. And they're, you know, 3, 4, 5 inches across. But now we're seeing smaller, and by the, must be millions, you know, when you're looking across an inner bay. And then we have the ones ocean swimmers are more concerned with, the lion's mane jelly, which is colorful. It's orange, purple, red, has long tentacles, and those tentacles have stinging cells. So if you weren't in a wetsuit, you know, and you bump into just a free-floating tentacle, you can get a rash from those. But we're seeing those, it seems, before. I mean, we've seen those. You'd see one over here, and then another day you'd see one. But now we're seeing them in 3, 4s, and 5s together and more commonly. So we think circulation and temperature are the main drivers.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can send a tweet to @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. Janet, I want to ask you if we are already seeing some of the impact of the ocean acidification, the ocean becoming slightly more acidic that we're seeing on the west coast of the United States.
So ocean acidification occurs when there's more carbon in the atmosphere. When that happens, anyone who's ever put vinegar and baking soda together and sees a reaction, shells like clam shells can dissolve. It's also much harder for them to get the carbonate, the calcium carbonate that they need. So this is a huge concern for places like Maine. We have seen, people have documented changes in shells for other commercial fisheries. And that is going to be an issue for us here in Maine, especially as we're putting more and more carbon into the atmosphere. So this is something that Mainers should definitely be thinking about, beyond the idea that the oceans are getting warmer. Other things are happening as well, including ocean acidification.
It seems to me, of all the things we've talked about so far, the thing in greatest peril is the clam flats, because we have both the green crabs and the ocean acidification. And I know also, Joe, you do a lot of work with nitrogen in the water, which also affects clam flats.
Right. And you're exactly right. What the problem now is that the green crab issue is masking anything else that's going on. You know, they're so obvious. You go, you look, you see them, and you see no clams. But the reality is the mud in Casco Bay is becoming acidic far faster than ocean acidification is going. So we call that coastal acidification. And researchers, Mark Green right here at St. Joseph's College, has found that at a pH of 6.8, 100% of the clam spat he exposed to that dissolved. We have clam flats in Casco Bay at a pH lower than 6.8. So we have problems right now. It's only 3 years from spat to harvest, and that's how quick it can affect clammers and the economy.
All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Casella, converting landfill gas to electricity, committed to providing clean, renewable energy for Mainers. Casella, giving resources new life. The Orthopedic Institute of Central Maine, committed to regaining mobility and getting rid of the pain, jointsme.org. And Baxter Brewing Company in Lewiston, celebrating the season with Summer Swelter, available through August, baxterbrewing.com.
Louis C.K. won an Emmy this week for writing an episode about a fat girl for his series Louis.
Guys like you never flirt with me.
On the next Fresh Air, he'll talk about writing that episode, and we'll feature an interview with Sarah Silverman, who just won an Emmy for writing her HBO Variety special, as we continue our mini-series of interviews with this week's Emmy winners. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. August is almost over. All this month, your fellow listeners have been taking pictures of themselves as they listen to MPBN Radio and sending them in, and we're sharing more and more of them. It's not too late. If you'd like to take part, submit a photo of yourself listening to any of our radio programs, and we'll post it. Also, let us know your name and where exactly you are and what you're listening to. For every photo submitted, Hunt's Photo Video, located in South Portland, will donate $5 to MPBN, a fun way to support MPBN. How to submit or how to see your fellow listeners? That's easy. Just go to mpbn.net and click on the banner or click on events for details. And thank you.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what's happening in the Gulf of Maine? With me in the studio, Joe Payne, who is Casco Bay Keeper with the Friends of Casco Bay. Adam Baucus, Research Associate at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. And Janet Gannon, she is a marine biology instructor at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or you can post to our Facebook page. A lot of talk about some of the serious things, but let's face it, it's just fun to see things that we wouldn't usually get to see. Janet, your most recent blog, and let me say the name of your blog, it's Maine Ocean Lover?
It's an ocean lover in Maine, and the web address is Maine Ocean Lover.
Maine Ocean Lover, at Blogspot?
Yep.
Okay, and so your latest post was on tide pooling. All of us have tide pooled, but how do you become an expert tide pooler? How do you get to see the best stuff?
Well, first of all, you got to get out there, and you got to choose a really good low tide. I would choose the lowest tide of the month to get out there, a spring tide. And you can look on any tide chart. It tells you how to do that. It tells you what the day is to get out there. Put on a great pair of shoes. You don't want to get your feet hurt. Be very careful of waves, so, you know, safety first. And then get out there and start looking. And I really encourage people to look for a long time. Take your time. Spend time looking under rocks. Don't be afraid to touch things unless they have claws. So if you find a one of the many green crabs out there are rock crabs or even a baby lobster. You probably don't want to touch it. And get out there, and I usually bring a bucket with me. I like to take a look at what's in that bucket afterwards. I always return things to the place where I found them. And it's one of the great things about Maine. There are some amazing places to tide pool. The Schoodick Peninsula is a great place. Giant Steps on Bailey's Island, or even Potts Point, which I just love. That's also in Harpswell. Going down east, if you were to go to Acadia, there's lots of places there to tide pool. Or even all the way out to West Quoddy Head, that's also a great place to go tide pooling. And it's a great thing that kids can do. There's a great tide pool in New Harbor. I believe it's preserved by the Nature Conservancy, the Rachel Carson Preserve. And it's very well protected. It's a safe place for kids to take a look, and they'll see things like hermit crabs and sea stars and sea anemones and lots of snails. And that's a great way to get kids out into the environment in a safe place.
Okay, Adam, any tips on seeing something cool?
Yeah, tide pooling is definitely one of my favorites. My only plug, so I'm always scouting big rocks because there's something going to be good hiding under those big rocks. I just make sure I don't flip anything that I can't put back. You know, I don't want to flip, you know, there's sessile organisms and things have made their home in there. And so it's great to take a peek and take a look. You're going to find some neat stuff. I just like to make sure I can put the rocks back. I also do a lot of snorkeling and boating. It's amazing what you can see, even just looking closely, even in the surf zone. If you go to the beach, if you stand in ankle-deep water, if you look closely, you're going to see a lot of organisms. There's a lot of clams burrowing down into the sand. There's a lot of small fish in just a couple inches of water. Off of any of the jetties or along the beaches, you're going to see, you know, we're talking about these jellyfish. They're going to be popping up everywhere. There'll be shoals of mackerel swimming around. I do a lot of snorkeling around the southern Maine area, and it's amazing how much you can see in 5 feet of water, even just snorkeling out.
Well, I was so interested. I went out with a research team from Gulf of Maine Research Institute last week. That video is on our website and on our Facebook page. And they had a very small area. They took a seine net, a 50-yard seine net, and pulled in what they could from a very small area. And there were dozens, if not hundreds, of small fish in that net. And if you were ankle deep in that water, you may not have even known they were there. It's astonishing. Joe, what about you? What are your tips?
Well, tide pooling, as Janet said, just get out there. And you'll see lots of stuff and you'll love it. But if you have the opportunity to go with somebody who knows the intertidal, we used to take people out. And I remember one trip, and these would be in tide pools on the islands, and we found it was 110 or 114 species in tide pools. And, you know, that's an amazing number. And I remember one of the guys we had with us said, I've been walking on this stuff, the algae, and through the tide pools my whole life. I had no idea that it was this kind of life. So tide pooling's great. If you have the opportunity, get out on the boat. I mean, if it's a ride on Casco Bay Lines, you're going to see some amazing stuff. You know, no one can guarantee it, but around here, the seals and certainly the gray seals now, the difference, the first time I saw a gray seal, I'm looking, I'm going, what the heck? That must be a gray seal. But harbor seals, big ones are 250 pounds. Gray seals are 800 pounds. I mean, there's no mistaking them. They're giants. So you can see that in Portland Harbor. But we also have white-sided dolphins. We have harbor porpoises. We have three kinds of whales you can commonly see around here. In the spring, you see pilot whales. And I want Janet to talk about, we were talking about basking sharks, which are unbelievable. But Janet, you just came from seeing some.
I did. Maine is amazing because we have the second largest mammal in the world that visits us, so the finback whale, which are just spectacular. But we also have the second largest fish in the world in our waters. And these would both be summer visitors. The basking shark is huge. It gets to be 30 feet long, many, many tons, probably well over 20 tons. And they do this not by eating big things like gray seals or fish. They do it by eating plankton. They tend to target copepods. And they just sort of lumber along with their mouth open. They have gill rakers. They're just gigantic. Their dorsal fin is like the size of a manhole cover. And this is just one of the most spectacular things. And it's right here in Maine. It's something you'd need to probably go relatively far off the coast to see. You wouldn't see it from shore or in a bay. But, you know, this is National Geographic quality stuff that we have that you could see from a whale watch.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. Whale watch captains, really know how to find the whales. Do you know how to find a basking shark, or do you have to get lucky?
You want to go on a really calm day. It was amazing that the day I went out on Saturday, and it was flat calm in the morning, and we saw at least 8 of them. And it's the second the wind picked up and we had a 1-foot chop, you couldn't see them at all. So it's going to be a lucky day when you get to see them. But we have whale watches all the way from our southern border all the way up to Lubeck and Eastport. So there's whale watches that run all through the state, and you can see amazing things from all of them. And they're all pretty good. They're all pretty reliable in terms of if you want to see a whale, you're probably going to see a whale out.
I had some great luck a few years ago riding on a boat from Monhegan Island into Port Clyde, and it was dusk, and we saw lots of dolphins and lots of whales. Was that a coincidence, or is indeed dusk a good time to see whales and dolphins and things like that?
I think that's probably coincidence. Okay. I think probably sightability is best when there's not a lot of waves. And certainly season is going to make a difference. You're going to want to go in the warmer months. And we have things that might be here during 1 month that are not here during the next month. And actually, a lot of the companies who do this will blog about what they're seeing. So if there's something you really want to see, you could follow those blogs and see, you know, is it common right now, and get out there and see it.
Great. Well, going to Susan in Falmouth. Hi, Susan. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi.
Go ahead.
So my question is, you know, I have a yard, and all the runoff from my yard goes straight into Casco Bay, of course. So I would just like to know, for the health of the bay, I realize there are a lot of big factors going on that I don't have immediate control over, but I do have control over what I put in my lawn or don't put in my lawn in my garden. And I wonder if you have any recommendations for what I should be doing to at least not harm the health of Casco Bay.
I have a feeling Joe Payne has an answer for you.
Hi, Susan. And I don't think you put bad things on your lawn, but there are things that people can do. As I think you know, we have a program called Bayscaping, how to keep our bay blue and keep your yard green. The biggest tips are for people who have grass, water properly and cut the grass at 3.5 inches, and that will keep your lawn healthy. In general, they don't need fertilizers, so don't put fertilizers and pesticides on your lawn 4 times a year as you're advised through lots of TV ads, because those things, pesticides, the Maine Board of Pesticides Control made it really easy for me. They said, if it will kill a bug, it will kill a lobster and a crab. We don't want that stuff in the bay. And as you said, it runs off into the bay. So don't use it unless you need it. And if you need it, if you have a spot on your lawn with grubs or something, just treat that spot if you have to. But don't put that pesticide over your whole lawn, which is the common practice. So, and go to our website, cascobay.org, and look for Bayscaping, and there'll be tips there about low fertilizer use or no fertilizer use, and the cutting and watering recommendations.
All right, Susan, thanks for your question. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, or you can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. Adam, you know, when I was a kid, there was a lot of publicity about the plastic rings that hold 6-packs of cans, and why we have to keep those out of the litter and out of the environment because they can do so much damage to marine animals. I haven't heard a lot about that lately. Is that sort of because there's so much awareness that that's not happening anymore, or is this still an issue? It's just not front and center like it was in the past.
I'd say it's certainly still an issue. I think there's definitely raised awareness, and there's a lot more events, ways for people to get involved, beach cleanups and things like that. As well as just those types of products are less prevalent because of the bad press in the past. But from what I've seen of ocean exploration and fishing, plastics in the ocean is definitely still an issue. And there's sizes of debris from microscopic all the way up to those big 6-pack rings or even larger. And all of those sizes of debris are going to affect various ocean life. It's certainly still a big problem.
Yeah, there was an article in the New York Times just a couple of days ago, and there are 3 or 4 major garbage patches in the world. And there was just a several-week cruise, and the people coming back were saying, it's amazing that it's grown. You know, now they describe it in the sizes of states, you know, the size of Connecticut, a garbage patch out in the middle of the ocean. And what I read, which really surprised me, is there are now places in those garbage patches that are so solid you can walk on them. Mm. And if this is mostly coming down our rivers and runoff and, you know, off the shore, and there are ways to stop and reduce that we should be working on.
Going to Tim in Waterville. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about the blue and other rare colored lobsters that get caught often and then end up in aquariums around the state and in New Hampshire. If the lobsters are being caught and then essentially being sequestered in aquariums, that might be good for the aquariums because people come and say, oh, I've never seen an albino lobster. I've never seen an albino lobster. But are we reducing the genetic diversity in the oceans by collecting all these rare-colored lobsters and removing them from the genetic population out in the open ocean?
Janet, do you know?
My understanding is that they're relatively rare. One in about 2 million is what we could expect to have a mutation for being a blue lobster. And I'm not sure that we're affecting their diversity in that way, because think about all the normal lobsters we're collecting. If it was a normal lobster, we would be removing it from the population as well. So I'm not sure that would be an issue. They're certainly great ambassadors for lobsters, and they're incredibly fascinating to see.
Go ahead, Joe.
I would just mention, I think that's a very thoughtful question. And to help balance that off in your mind a little bit, some scientists use blue lobsters and they breed them and put them back into the wild as a way to track lobster movements and other things. So in some cases, those captured lobsters are going on for the greater good.
All right. And Tim, your question leads me to a question I have for the panel here, which is, I understand we have record numbers of lobster in the Gulf of Maine. What's going on? Why are there so many lobster right now?
Well, that's, again, you know, a pretty complicated question. It's easy to say there are definitely a ton of lobsters right now. You know, when we look at previous years, the temperature spikes in the water has changed, not necessarily the number of lobsters, but their molting cycle and when we catch them during the year, and that has certainly created some headlines. But why there are so many lobsters right now is definitely a big scientific debate right now. There's a lot of food for them. There's a lot of habitat. There's discussions around maybe the predators that were previously there are now lower. Cod is a good example. The cod stocks are low right now, and they're historically a good predator of lobsters. And it's most likely a combination of multiple factors.
Yeah, but it seems too, temperature is implicated because the lobster fisheries to the south of us are going down while ours is increasing. And even in just the coast of Maine, the lobster catches are far greater on the northeast end of our coast than they are on the southern part, as the temperatures are cooler the further north you go.
We're talking about our changing ocean ecosystem. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Cabot Creamery, whose Maine dairy farmers welcome visitors to sample regional cheeses and craft beers at their Old Port Annex in Portland and Roosevelt Campobello International Park, the summer home of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, now open for its 50th season, FDR.net.
Hello, I'm Linda Hunt. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Alec Baldwin. The actor and producer is well known for his turn as the supremely confident cutthroat executive, Jack Dunnity, on NBC's 30 Rock. Join me next time for a conversation with Alec Baldwin on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
And you can hear that this afternoon at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling.
A lot of apps out there. Stitch Fix takes personal stylists and big data and creates a whole new shopping experience.
Behind the scenes, we really combine the power of what data and algorithms can do so that when our stylist is making selections for you, they really have the best-in-class information at their fingertips.
I'm David Gura, a conversation with Stitch Fix founder Katrina Lake, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tune in for Marketplace this evening at 6:30.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the creatures living off the coast of Maine. With me in the studio, Joe Payne, who is Casco Bay keeper with Friends of Casco Bay, Adam Bacchus, a research associate at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and Janet Gannon, a marine biology instructor at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. I want to read an email from Andy. He writes, I've heard that an important predator of jellyfish is the sea turtle, and that the numbers of the sea turtle are declining because they eat the floating white plastic shopping bags, which shuts the turtle's digestive system down and kills this important control of jellyfish. Is this something either of any of you have heard about?
So that is a concern for sea turtles. Debris in the ocean is a big concern for sea turtles. They do mistake plastic bags for jellyfish. There are actually a lot of populations of sea turtles that are doing well. And here in Maine, sea turtles tend to be relatively rare visitors. I think probably Adam and Joe would agree with me on that. Yep. It's a little too cold here for them. If they do get up here, it'll be in the summer, and they won't make it too far past summer because it's just too cold for them. They get cold shocked and they die. We do have a really interesting fish that eats jellyfish here, the mola mola. That is just my favorite thing in the world.
The mola mola
is also known as the ocean sunfish. It's a summer visitor, and one of its primary prey items is the jellyfish. So, you know, maybe jellyfish aren't so great if you're a swimmer, but if you're a mola mola, you'd be really happy to see a lot of jellyfish.
Okay, yeah. Then. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, and that's something, you know, the mola is a really unique visitor. We've actually seen them recently just outside of Casco Bay. I call them the ocean couch cushions. They're a really weird-looking fish. They're a big disc-shaped fish. They've got sort of big gangly fins on either side, and you'll see them flapping around the surface. But they get huge. They can get 8-9 feet long, and they're sort of big leathery skin, and their movements aren't that well known, so they do come close to shore, and you might be able to see one.
We have an email from Jonas. He says, I live in Freeport. A local clammer told me that he has not seen green crabs this year. Has this been statewide? Also, what is the deal with the amazing green phosphorescence in the water right now? What is it?
The green crab catches reported so far have been down. They have started to pick up. The pickup has been more in deep water, but I think that they are here still in lesser numbers earlier this season. But it's, you know, as I said earlier, we don't know what's going to happen next week. The phosphorescence in the water most likely is due to ctenophores or ctenophores. It's a jelly, not the jellyfish that we used to call it, but gives amazing light from these 8 rows of phosphorescent organs that it has. They're about the size, there's 2 species, but about the size of a golf ball or at most a pear. Hmm. And at night in boat wakes or run your hand through the water, it's amazing to see.
Wow. Going to Chris in Portland. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Great panel today. Thank you. So it would seem that we have all of the characteristics to support a great white shark population. I'm just curious, with the recent migration northward that we've seen in Massachusetts, is there any data that you guys are seeing or even anecdotal data that they're actually here and around?
Yeah, so we talked about that a little earlier in the show, and these guys say, yes, we have great white sharks in Maine. Is there any data on how many there are?
They're starting to do programs to track them. A lot of them are based, you know, down in Cape Cod, and they're learning more and more about where these sharks go. Personally, I have seen a shark as far north as Monhegan Island, so they are around.
Great. You've ruined my day.
Thanks, Chris. Going to Frank and Machias. Frank, you have one of several green crab questions. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I'm just wondering if anything's being done about controlling or getting rid of the green crabs, and also is anything being done about helping the acidification of the ocean, and also are the snails in Casco Bay edible? Are they a commercial possibility?
Well, green crabs, there are several people working on several fronts trying to make an edible product, thinking that will be the answer for us if we make it something edible. But also people are investigating cat food, compost, fertilizer. And one of the problems is nobody wants to fish all day for hundreds of thousands of pounds of green crabs and not be able to make a day's pay, because right now no one's willing to pay enough for them. But there's a lot of work. On acidification, Maine just formed an ocean acidification panel It has met once. They're going to deliver a report possibly in December, and hopefully that work will continue. So there's the beginning of that. And I forget the third question, but I think it was for someone else.
Can you eat the snails?
Yeah, so common periwinkles, the Litorina litorea, are mm-hmm. edible. And in fact, in the northern parts of our state and across the border in Canada, there's a pretty viable fishery for them. They're called wrinkles up there. We would call them periwinkles. But you can actually, if you go down east, there'll be signs that saying, you know, wrinkles wanted, buying wrinkles. So people are collecting them. And I understand that I have tried them. I decided to give them a go. I didn't love them, but I understand there's a pretty large demand in some parts of the world for periwinkles.
Great.
And I do love them.
So there you go, Frank. Thanks for your question. We have an email from Robin Hadlock-Seeley at the Shoals Marine Lab. She says, stresses on the ocean ecosystem in Maine include intertidal habitat alteration through ever-increasing rockweed harvest for agricultural fertilizer production, 16.5 million pounds last year. It's hard to bring back fisheries, she writes, when the habitat is being altered more and more every year.
So I have seen, I've seen Ascophyllum. Robin is referring to rockweed. Some people call it knotted rack. It's proper species name is Ascophyllum nodosum. It's sort of the long, stringy seaweed that you see in bays and harbors. And I have seen harvest in Casco Bay, right out of Cundy's Harbor. And I've seen harvesters down east as well. And my understanding is there is an increase in our harvest of this. And one of the things that is sort of the way we might want to think about our oceans is there's a lot of different stresses on them. And as we put a lot of different stresses all in at the same time, it's something for us to consider. So things like fisheries restoration, we do need to think about their habitat.
Okay, and I think we have another seaweed question from York. Torbert, go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer. We have an inundation of invasive seaweed down here, which I'm sure will spread further up the coast. Something from Japan and ballast water. It's small like Irish moss, and it really, really stinks upon arrival on the beaches and decays quickly, and is really a threat to our tourist industry here, and I'm sure it can't be doing any good for the fisheries ecosystem either. What possible remedies do we have?
You have three scientists shaking their heads.
This has been happening in Massachusetts around Nahant for years and years. They've been working on it. If you look on the web, you'll find information. But as far as control, I don't think anyone has the answer yet.
Mm. Yeah, and I've heard of other examples of green algae in the southern Maine area really affecting some of the aquaculture areas and sort of spreading to larger areas where it's going to start affecting tourism. And you know, you can start pinpointing where some of the nutrients that are causing these blooms might be coming from, but and that might be a starting point. But other than that, it's a tough one.
Thanks for your call, Torbert. Good luck. And headed to Cape Elizabeth and Dan. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi. I wanted to – there's recently been reports that something that is out in the ocean in huge numbers is dogfish. So I wanted to get the panel's response – on that issue, and maybe first, I'm just wondering. I mean, these reports, more or less, what they said is that they're voracious predators, and we have to do something to get rid of them. And but it seems like the articles I've been seeing lately say that habitat should be managed to encourage predators, and then that more or less filters down through the entire habitat to make it more healthy. So. Just wondering what the panel has to say about that.
Yeah, I can certainly jump in. From working with commercial fishermen, you know, dogfish is a predator shark. It's interesting the way I hadn't heard people really refer to it as a top predator, and that's a version of a healthy ecosystem, because I hear from fishermen where they're trying to catch other groundfish species and all they can catch is dogfish. So there's certainly a lot of dogfish in the Gulf of Maine, and they are a great predator. I think a good way to describe it is they're a really good generalist. So they're able to eat a wide variety of prey items. And so that makes them able to move into a whole bunch of different habitat types and be a factor in that area. And there's not a whole lot, you know, they're a tricky species. There's not a lot that actually preys on dogfish. Really large predators will. It's interesting. And the management of them is certainly a hot topic. We're learning more and more about their movement patterns and really just getting a beat on how many there are and where they are and when is not as straightforward as it is in other fish species. They do move a lot, and their reproduction, we're learning more and more about it, is pretty unique. So getting a gauge on when they're spawning and where the hotspots are and where to find them in order to make an educated guess about how many there are is a little tricky. So that's an ongoing science.
Is there a market? Do people eat dogfish?
There is a market. And it's great fish to eat. It's not all that popular. At the lab, we've got some programs where we try to promote some of these species that aren't as popular, that are really healthy, and they're very good for you to eat. You know, one of the people at the lab say, well, if you're eating catfish, why not eat a dogfish? and they are. They're a nice, light, mild fish. It's not something you'd probably go to the market and pick, but it's worth a try.
Okay, we have an email back to the green crabs. Are green crabs edible? How large are they in our waters so far? If I go tide pooling and grab a bunch of green crabs, no.
Unlikely you would want to eat them. I think they can be eaten. Joe might know they can.
They taste good. The problem is they're small, and they don't have a lot of meat per individual, but there are plenty of them, and if you have the time and patience to pick them out, it's okay. Been found the easiest way to get the meat out is to roll them, and then you have a paste. The paste isn't so eye-appealing.
And cover it in Old Bay. You'll get it.
Old Bay. A caller that had to go wanted to know whether iron oxide can be used to reduce acidification in the water. Is that something you all have heard discussed?
I've heard it discussed. I heard there were pros, but now it seems like the cons are coming out, that there are reasons, there are unintended consequences, and that's all that I know about it.
An email from Mike, he writes, could you please comment on the health of and the importance of saltwater marshes in Maine? Janet?
Wow, well, we have some amazing salt marshes, especially in the southern part of our state. There's a giant salt marsh there in Scarborough. I don't know that I can talk a lot about their health compared to maybe many years ago. One of the problems with salt marshes is that we've built a lot near or on them, so that is a huge issue. And there is some concern recently in terms of green crabs in the banks of salt marshes, so that's something to keep your eye on.
A little bit of time left, but we have a great question. Juliana writes, asks on the Maine Calling Facebook page, my daughter loves all things ocean. What tips do you have for a 13-year-old who's interested in marine biology? She would love some real hands-on experiences.
Go tide pooling. But I don't know what age range, and I should, but for fish camp run by Mr. and Mrs. Fish over at SMCC. But if she's in that age range, that's a fantastic place to go. 13's a little young for interning and those sorts of things.
So. But there are some volunteer monitoring programs up and down the coast. I know you all have some families can pick a beach or
right. With families, for us, like water quality, kids need to be 16 to participate on their own. But we have families where the children have grown up from 3 years to college doing water quality monitoring. So, yes, that's exposure. But, you know, the things we talked about, whale watches and tide pooling again, those are fabulous introductions.
Yeah, and we've got a few programs at the lab where they really encourage sort of citizen science. So vitalsigns.org is a great spot to go and look, and that's something where you can go out and make observations and learn about what you're seeing, sharing that data right into the scientific community and really sort of getting involved that way.
And also protecting the ocean. We have a program where kids take kits that we've put together and they go out and stencil storm drains, don't dump here, and that works. We don't have time, but I have lots of anecdotes how that has stopped bad stuff from going into the ocean. And kids do that and they enjoy it, I think mostly because they get to paint their sneakers a little bit. But but that's a good thing to look at.
Well, thank you all three for being here for this great program. Janet Gannon, marine biology instructor at Bowdoin College. Adam Baucus, a research associate at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. And Joe Payne, Casco Bay keeper with the Friends of Casco Bay. John Keimel ran the board for today's show. And our volunteer, Cindy Hahn, answered your calls. This show was also produced by our intern, Charlotte Ruddy, as well as our regular producer, Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, the Maine Calling Book Club returns with a discussion about Barbara Walsh's book, August Gale, A Father and Daughter's Journey into the Storm. It's the story of her own family's history and a Newfoundland Gale of historic proportion. The book has been praised by critics for its historical and emotional resonance. That's tomorrow, the Maine Calling Book Club. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.